Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. It's no secret, Americans are obsessed with dieting and constantly in search of the perfect, or at least better, body. We all know the saying, one can never be too thin, but maybe we can, and that is the subject of our interview this week with Joan Jacobs Brumberg, author of Fasting Girls, A History of Anorexia. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. This week, on February 1, 1861, Texas voted to secede from the Union, making it the seventh of 11 states to secede following the election of President Abraham Lincoln. South Carolina was the first state to secede on December 20, 1860. North Carolina was the last on May 20, 1861. At 4:30 in the morning on April 12, 1861, Southern forces opened fire on the Union garrison Fort Sumter, South Carolina, plunging the North and South into a war that lasted 4 years and took the lives of over 600,000 soldiers, more than any other war in American history. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, during World War II it was common knowledge that British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and future French President Charles de Gaulle did not see eye to eye on many political and military issues. Recently released documents, however, reveal just how deep their personal enmity toward one another really was. Soon after moving his military headquarters to Britain in 1940, Churchill became fed up with what he saw as de Gaulle's endless ambition and extreme Anglophobia. Churchill wrote to his deputy, Clement Attlee, "He is, in my opinion, absorbed in his own personal career, which depends on a vain endeavor to make himself arbiter of the conduct of every Frenchman." Nevertheless, Churchill took the advice of his own cabinet not to withdraw support from de Gaulle for fear that Germany would take advantage of the rift in Allied leaders. In 1993, Steven Spielberg made the name Oscar Schindler famous in his award-winning film Schindler's List. The name is back in the news and reports out of Germany that an original list of Jewish employees drawn up by Oskar Schindler to save them from Nazi death camps has been discovered. The papers were found in a suitcase full of papers left to a German couple who were relatives of close friends of the German magnate. Schindler wrote the names of 1,200 Jews at the Plaszow concentration camp and gave the list to the Nazi SS, saying the people were needed for employment at his factory in Krakow, Poland. You're listening to Talking History.
Your butt is right, well, mine is too. Just watch your mouth, or I'll spit on you. The word is out, better treat me right. Cause I'm the king of cellulite.
Weight loss machines and diet foods are among the best-selling consumer products in America. Indeed, Americans seem obsessed with the idea of losing weight. Is this obsession with dieting new? What lies behind our never-ending quest, especially among women, to lose weight, to develop what we consider to be more attractive, meaning thinner, bodies? Talking History's Dennis Mihalik is here to explore that subject with historian Joan Jacobs Brumberg.
January, among other things, is National Diet Month. Here to put the female portion of the American dieting craze in perspective is Joan Jacobs Brumberg, a professor at Cornell University who teaches in the fields of history, human development, and women's studies. Dr. Brumberg is the prize-winning author of Fasting Girls, A History of Anorexia Nervosa, a publication by Penguin Books, and The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, published by Vintage. Welcome, Professor Brumberg.
Thank you for having me.
In The Body Project, you argued that a revolution has occurred in the last century in terms of the way women relate to their bodies. What changed and why?
Well, in a nutshell, women have become much more critical of their bodies, and I was able to describe this psychological shift from measuring their self-worth in terms of good works to good looks in my book, The Body Project. And I did that by looking at girls' diaries. In the 19th century, characteristically, girls are concerned about their relationship to others, their service to others, and their character. What happens in the 20th century is that all the energy seems to be focused on appearance issues. And the saddest part is that the self-critique, in other words, when something goes wrong in your life and you're upset about your friends or your family or school or whatever, it's now not about character, but about appearance. So you get lines like, my life would be perfect, you know, if only I weighed 10 pounds less, or only I had better skin, or nicer hair, or a better figure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, why would such a move from character to body image take place?
Well, that's a complicated question, and it has to do with a lot of things that I talk about in the book. I mean, most people typically blame it on media. And while the media are certainly implicated, you can't blame it all on Calvin Klein. It starts earlier with different forms of media, photography, movies, advertising, all of the things that constitute modern visual culture. But it also has to do, you know, with changes in hygiene and health, greater attention to cleanliness issues in the body, the investment of middle-class parents in their daughter's skin, the emergence of dermatology, the investment of parents in their kids' teeth, orthodonture, you can see where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
That the medicalization of life in the United States also has been a contributing factor to the notion of an ideal body, and girls seem to have internalized this more in a visual culture than they did back in the 19th century, when many of them didn't even have mirrors, for example, in their homes. So the introduction of new technologies, such as the bathroom mirror, electric lights, and running water. Just think about the modern bathroom and how important it is to this appearance issue. And then the introduction of the domestic bathroom scale after World War II. I mean, until that time, most women were going to drugstores or to gymnasiums to weigh themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say an ideal body. I mean, has the image of an ideal female body changed over time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's always changing. And, you know, there is a neat chronology that suggests, well, in the Victorian period, women wanted a wasp, tiny waist, and an ample bosom and hips. And the ample bosom and hips was a sign that you weren't sick with one of the wasting diseases that were that terrorized people in the 19th century. By the early 19-teens and the 1920s, culture is changing, so is the ideal, a flatter bosom, a more youthful as opposed to matronly look. More and more cultural attention is given to legs as the shirts, get shorter. But as the shirts get more minimal too, we begin to see more attention to the hairless ideal. And you get the first ads for depilatories to remove underarm hair and also leg hair and silk stockings. Come in. By the 1950s, full bosom, much like the Madonna ideal, you know, the pointed cone-shaped bras and girdles, even for young women. And then by the 1960s, you know, the blue jeaning revolution changes all that and shifts our eye and our interest to the pelvis and buttocks and thighs, and that's when you begin to see in girls' diaries talk about thunder thighs. I would say that at the end of the century, the 1980s and 1990s, now, the emphasis is on a very, very slim, if not emaciated, female body, but it also must be toned, and there must be some musculature, especially in the upper arms, and you're supposed to have an absolutely flat pelvis as well, and that should be manicured. By that I mean the bikini line area must be hairless. And so what's happened now is that the pressure is on the upper and the lower body in terms of the ideal. So that's one of the interesting things, is what body parts are emphasized in the aesthetic or the ideal of different historical eras.
Mm-hmm. So that, like today, we see a lot of emphasis put on women working out and all these workout tapes that are sold. When did, as opposed to working out, when did dieting come into fashion?
Well, dieting is really modern dieting as we know it, a female activity, not a male activity, and not just for health, but primarily for beauty, right? That kind of dieting, beauty-centered by women, is really a feature of, begins to be a feature of American culture in the 1920s. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the cowrie is invented, if you will, in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, you can't count cowries until you know what a cowrie is, until that concept is available. It spread through a lot of the columns by beauty editors in magazines and newspapers in the 20s. It fits with the streamlining of fashion in the 20s, you know, the move to the chemise dress, shorter, showing more flesh. And it seems to me, from what I can, what I've uncovered in my research, is that a lot of adolescent girls caught on to, adolescent and young adults, excuse me, girls caught on to this idea of dieting and calorie counting, and they actually taught it to their mothers, who for the first time, that was the first generation really of American matrons, married women, I'd say 40 plus, who started to be concerned about being stout, being too stout. And you see that the fashion industry begins to say to them, look, here is a style that will make you appear slim and not stout, not too robust. Mm-hmm. So it's the 1920s, really. And that, you know, that fits with other things that are going on, too, in movies and department stores, and the insurance industry has begun to connect overweight to mortality, and pediatricians are issuing more and more height and weight charts. So the 20s are really a critical decade in terms of the history of modern dieting.
Mm-hmm. And in the 20s, you say, medicine, is this when they came up with these standardized weight charts?
That's when they really become, you know, I would say more commonplace, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I mean, what's the relationship between a dieting for body image and anorexia?
Well, that's a good question. Today, the relationship seems to be quite clear because the modern ideal body configuration, which is extremely thin, seems to be implicated in the behavior of most anorexic girls. Most of them say, I am too fat. Now, what's interesting, though, is that anorexia nervosa emerged as a modern disease entity in the 1870s, long before Twiggy or Kate Moss. So, you know, you have to go back and look at the context of anorexia nervosa in the 19th century to try to understand what was going on. Although I have never seen the diary of a 19th century anorexic girl that says, I did not eat because, so of course I am speculating based on what I know about the culture and what the medical case records say. I think it would be fair to say that girls, for Victorian girls, food and eating also had a negative meaning. The meaning, though, was different than today. Today, girls don't want to eat or be fat because they think that that's not sexy. In the 19th century, many girls didn't want to eat. They didn't want to eat meat, and they didn't want to eat much because they wanted to disassociate themselves from food and eating, which they considered an emblem of their carnality and lack of control and a lack of self-restraint. You follow what I'm saying? They they wanted to be ascetic. They wanted to appear to not have any earthly, fleshy, carnal needs. And they also didn't want to be heavy or robust for class reasons. They didn't want to appear to look like working class girls. They didn't want to look like a milkmaid anymore. So there's a whole configuration of ideas about food, eating, body, and social class that existed in the 19th century that probably fueled anorexia nervosa in that era. They're somewhat different than today.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, the difference between a middle class person and a milkmaid, I mean, are women of all classes and, say, all cultures, African-Americans or Europeans and Latin Americans, I mean, are they in a similar dieting craze, and do they have a similar crisis with anorexia?
Well, it's a very good question. There are some important class and ethnic differences. The literature to date seems to suggest that African-American women are less vulnerable to developing eating disorders because they tend to have a more fluid, more accepting notion of what makes for female beauty. The problem with some of that research is that it doesn't control for social class differences. It also seems that as different groups kind of move up in the hierarchy of social classes, in other words, as they move out of the working class into the middle and upper middle classes, that their daughters become more vulnerable or more at risk for anorexia nervosa. This was true of American Jews. It appears to be true of African Americans. It appears to be true of Asian Americans. So that's the answer for the U.S., that social class really trumps race in terms of what's salient. And the more affluent you are, the more likely you are to develop eating disorders, although I should say that this is much more true of anorexia nervosa than bulimia. Bulimia seems to be more democratic, if you will, with a small d. I don't mean the party. The other thing that's interesting is that in other countries, yeah, there is quite a bit of anorexia nervosa these days. It's new. My books have been translated into Japanese, which I find really interesting, and German, so that tells you something about where these things are occurring. It's also true in Rio, in Brazil. I think the answer to that question is that wherever there are westernizing influences and a certain kind of idealized beauty, probably perpetuated through American television and movies, you know, and MTV, stuff like that, plus a certain level of affluence and a certain kind of intensive family life, you know, close parenting, not a lot of children, you're going to see anorexia nervosa.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier, you dismissed males in this dieting and anorexia. I mean, is there a male counterpart? Well, in your definition, you said that you're defining
it
as female dieting. Yes. Is there a male counterpart to this?
Well, there is in the sense, there are two ways to answer that. I think one is that there are some boys and men who get into steroid abuse, certainly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of pumping up, who get into exercise addiction. Some people see that as a male counterpart. In terms of this preoccupation with bodily perfection. But, you know, the second part of an answer to your question about gender difference is that at the end of the 20th century, it seems to me that both men and women alike, even middle-aged people like me, have somehow in this culture come to believe that the body is perfectible. And that's reflected in our behaviors. Much of it devoted to wellness, you know, to healthful activities, walking and exercise and exercise of all kinds and nutritional diets. But we are a culture that believes that the body is perfectible, male and female alike, and so we're beginning to see more and more pressure on young boys for them, too, to have perfect bodies. Having said that there are more male cases of eating disorders now than there were 20 years ago, still this is disproportionately a behavior, a syndrome, a disorder, a disease associated with women and girls.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Professor Joan Jacobs Brumberg, author of Fasting Girls and The Body Project, for this very interesting discussion.
Hey, you get a bikini, you got to eat it, mind.
As a young man, Bill Gary wanted to be an historian, but instead he became the editor of a magazine devoted to food called Bon Appetit. Gary never lost his love of history, and the opportunity arose for him to combine his love of history and food when the magazine published a special issue recently on the American century in food. What role does food play in history? Well, let Bill Gary explain.
How a country eats, and what it eats, and even where it eats, affects and is in turn affected by the major currents of history. the growth of automobile travel, for example, is inseparable from the growth of roadside restaurants, and this culminates in national food chains. There are other connect-to-the-dots things that I think are fascinating in terms of history and food. Look at electricity, for example. It wasn't long after Edison's experiments that we first had refrigeration, which led to home refrigerators, which revolutionized the way the housewife could manage her kitchen and keep food around. And that led in turn to Clarence Birdseye and the first frozen foods, which tied in, of course, with the railroads as well, because that was the way things were transported in those days. Suddenly, in a very short period of time early in the century, we went from being a country that ate only what was grown locally to what was grown all over the country, and now all over the world. How we travel has also had its connect-the-dots effects. The railroads led to dining cars, which led to diners and the idea of this small restaurant. And certain things were invented because of railroads. Bisquick came about because one of the General Mills executives tried biscuits that were made very quickly by a railway chef, and he had invented basically the dough for Bisquick. Cars and highways and the American need to travel created Howard Johnson's and Stuckey's and McDonald's and all the things we think of. This wouldn't have existed without Henry Ford, who said, in fact, history is bunk. Well, he was wrong. Entertainment is a big part of the way food connects. World's fairs have introduced all kinds of new things. If there hadn't been baseball, there probably wouldn't have been hot dogs. People needed to eat something of that new form of entertainment at the beginning of the century, and along came the hot dog in the first decade. Radio and television have led to things like TV dinners, which may or may not be good, but also changing the style of the way people eat at home and the way we relate to things, not to mention marketing of food. And the big political movements and major events have also had their effect. Prohibition, which started in 1920, introduced the age of the speakeasy, and in fact most of the cocktails we know today happened during the period of Prohibition. It also got Franklin Roosevelt elected the first time. The Depression and World War II changed the style of the way people looked at food. Rationing created new types of dinners, and the fact that people didn't have much money meant that they had to focus on the home again. And the boom times after the war recreated the American kitchen. The revolts of the 60s also had their effect. And innovation, from the toaster to the blender to the microwave and now the internet, is all affecting social change and the way we think of food. Now everyone is going to be eating globally, and everyone is going to be aware of what everyone else is eating in this country. Things have changed a great deal in 100 years, and the connection of history to food will continue to go on. And we won't be able to see it from a day-to-day basis, but if you look back even 10 years and dig a little deeper in what you're eating, you're going to find a very rich vein of history as well.
You've been listening to Bill Gary, editor of Bon Appetit magazine, and this is Talking History.
Potato skin, potato cake, hash brown, and instant flakes, baked or boiled, or fresh fried. There's no kind you haven't tried. You better trip.
Continuing on the subject of food, or our attempt to abstain from it, for our site of the week, we give you Food for Thought. Here to explain is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Food for Thought, a Sheldon Gallery statewide exhibition in Nebraska, provides an opportunity to survey food as a subject for works of art, both philosophically and stylistically. Still life painting, from its earliest expression in classical times to its development by 17th century Dutch painters, has been a subject of fascination for artists. In the 20th century, American artists have explored the theme in a variety of styles and media, from Hans Hofmann's cubist-inspired painting Fruit Bowl to Andy Warhol's Soup Can Silkscreen. Also included in the exhibition are well-known American artists Martin Hartley and Edward Weston. Food for Thought will be exhibited in Columbus at the Columbus Art Gallery April 2nd to May 5th. Contact the Sheldon Gallery in Lincoln, Nebraska for more dates and locations.
Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we recommend to you another museum exhibit, this time a recently opened permanent exhibit at the National Museum of Natural History titled African Voices. The 6,500-square-foot exhibit, filled with historical artifacts, tells the story of African history, politics, economics, and religion from its distant past, still largely unknown to most people outside the continent, to the present. For more information on African Voices, contact the National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. Turning to television, PBS's American Experience will take a look at the construction of Hoover Dam, one of the greatest engineering works in history, and Duke Ellington's Washington in two shows that will air on February 7th. On February 9th, PBS will premiere The Greeks, Crucible of Civilization, as part of its Empire special, highlighting the rise, glory, demise, and legacy of that great empire that gave birth to Western civilization. For a lighter touch, tune in the History Channel on February 7th for The Sportscasters and experience the thrills of victory and the agonies of defeat as described by broadcast legends Kurt Gowdy, Red Barber, Mal Allen, Harry Carey, and many more. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we take a look at Senator Joseph McCarthy and the anti-communist crusade he led in the 1950s. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Other kids are starving in Japan, so eat it. Just eat it.